Sri Kalindi said, I am the daughter of the sun god. I desire to get as my husband the most excellent and munificent Lord Vishnu, and to that end I am performing severe penances. I will accept no husband other than him, the abode of the goddess of fortune. May that Mukunda, the supreme personality, the shelter of the helpless, be pleased with me. I am known as Kalindi, and I live in a mansion my father built for me within the water of the Yamuna. There I will stay until I meet Lord Achyuta. Shukadev Goswami continued, Arjuna repeated all this to Lord Vasudev, who was already aware of it. The Lord then took Kalindi onto his chariot and went back to see King Yudhishthir. Describing a previous incident, Shukadev Goswami said, Upon the request of the Pandavas, Lord Krishna had Vishwakarma build them a most wonderful and amazing city. The Supreme Lord stayed in that city for some time to please his devotees. On one occasion, Sri Krishna wanted to give the Kandava forest as a gift to Agni, and so the Lord became Arjuna's charioteer. Being pleased, Lord Agni presented Arjuna with a bow, a set of white horses, a chariot, a pair of inexhaustible quivers, and armor that no fighter could pierce with weapons. When the demon Maya was saved from the fire by his friend Arjuna, Maya presented him with an assembly hall in which Duryodhana would later mistake water for a solid floor. Then Lord Krishna, given leave by Arjuna and other well-wishing relatives and friends, returned to Dwarka with Satyaki and the rest of his entourage. The supremely auspicious Lord then married Kalindi on a day when the season, the lunar asterism, and the configurations of the sun and other heavenly bodies were all propitious. In this way he brought the greatest pleasure to his devotees. Vindhya and Anuvindhya, who shared the throne of Avanti, were followers of Duryodhana's. When the time came for their sister Mitravinda to select her husband in the Swayamvara ceremony, they forbade her to choose Krishna, although she was attracted to him. My dear king, Lord Krishna forcibly took away Princess Mitravinda, the daughter of his aunt Rajadi Devi, before the eyes of the rival kings. Nagnajit, the very pious king of Kaushalya, had a lovely daughter named Satya, or Nagnajiti. The kings who came as suitors were not allowed to marry her unless they could subdue 7 sharp-horned bulls. These bulls were extremely vicious and uncontrollable, and they could not tolerate even the smell of warriors. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the master of the Vaishnavas, heard of the princess who was to be won by the conqueror of the bulls, he went to the capital of Kaushalya with a large army. The king of Kaushala, pleased to see Lord Krishna, worshipped him by rising from his throne and offering him a seat of honor and substantial gifts. Lord Krishna also greeted the king respectfully. When the king's daughter saw that most agreeable suitor arrive, she immediately desired to have him, the lord of goddess Rama. She prayed, May he become my husband. If I have kept my vows, may the sacred fire bring about the fulfillment of my hopes. Goddess Lakshmi, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the rulers of the various planets place the dust of his lotus feet on their heads. And to protect the codes of religion which he has created, he assumes pastime incarnations at various times. How may that Supreme Personality of Godhead become pleased with me? King Nagnajit first worshipped the Lord properly and then addressed him. O Narayan, Lord of the universe, you are full in your own spiritual pleasure. Therefore, what can this insignificant person do for you? Shukadev Goswami said, O beloved descendant of Kuru, the Supreme Lord was pleased, and after accepting a comfortable seat, he smiled and addressed the king in a voice as deep as the rumbling of a cloud. The Supreme Lord said, O ruler of men, learned authorities condemn begging for a person in the royal order who is executing his religious duties. Even so, desiring your friendship, I ask you for your daughter, though we offer no gifts in exchange. The king said, My lord, who could be a better husband for my daughter than you, the exclusive abode of all transcendental qualities? On your body the goddess of fortune herself resides, never leaving you for any reason. But to ascertain the proper husband for my daughter, we previously set a condition to test the prowess of her suitors. These 7 wild bulls are impossible to tame, O hero. They have defeated many princes, breaking their limbs. If you can subdue them, O descendant of Yadu, you will certainly be the appropriate bridegroom for my daughter. Upon hearing these terms, the lord tightened his clothing, expanded himself into 7 forms, and easily subdued the bulls. Lord Krishna tied up the bulls, whose pride and strength were now broken, and pulled them with ropes, just as a child playfully pulls wooden toy bulls. Then King Nagnajit, pleased and astonished, presented his daughter to Lord Krishna. The Supreme Personality of Godhead accepted this suitable bride in the proper Vedic fashion. The king's wives felt the greatest ecstasy upon attaining Lord Krishna as the dear husband of the royal princess, and a mood of great festivity arose. Conch shells, horns, and drums resounded, along with vocal and instrumental music and the sounds of Brahmins invoking blessings. The joyful men and women adorned themselves with fine clothing and garlands. As the dowry, powerful King Nagnajit gave 10,000 cows, 3,000 young maidservants wearing golden ornaments on their necks and bedecked in fine clothing, 9,000 elephants, 100 times as many chariots as elephants, 100 times as many horses as chariots, and 100 times as many manservants as horses. The bride and groom mounted their chariot, surrounded by a great army. Then the king of Kosala, his heart melting with affection, sent them on their way. When the intolerant kings who had been rival suitors heard what had happened, they tried to stop Lord Krishna on the road as he took his bride home. But just as the bulls had broken their strength before, the Yadu warriors broke it now. Arjuna, wielder of the Gandiva bow, was always eager to please his friend Krishna, and thus he drove back those opponents who were shooting torrents of arrows at the Lord. He did this just as a lion drives away insignificant animals. Lord Krishna, the chief of the Yadus, then took his dowry and satya to Dwaraka and continued to live there happily. Bhadra was a princess of the Kaikeya kingdom and the daughter of Lord Krishna's paternal aunt, Shrutakirti. The Lord married Bhadra when her brothers, headed by Santardhan, offered her to him. Then the Lord married Lakshmana, the daughter of the king of Madra. Krishna appeared alone at her Swayamvara ceremony and took her away, just as Garuda once stole the demigod's nectar. Lord Krishna also acquired thousands of other wives equal to these, when he killed Gomasura and freed the beautiful maidens the demon was holding captive. Chapter 59, The Killing of the Demon Naraka. King Parikshit said, "How was Gomasura, who kidnapped so many women, killed by the Supreme Lord? Please narrate this adventure of Lord Shangadanda's." Sukadeva Goswami said, "After Boma had stolen the earrings belonging to Indra's mother, along with Varuna's umbrella and the demigod's playground at the peak of Mandara Mountain, Indra went to Lord Krishna and informed him of these misdeeds. The Lord, taking his wife Satyabhama with him, then rode on Garuda to Pragyotishapur, which was surrounded on all sides by fortifications consisting of hills, unmanned weapons, water, fire, and wind, and by obstructions of Murapasha wire. With his club, the Lord broke through the rock fortifications, with his arrows, the weapon fortifications, with his disc, the fire, water, and wind fortifications, and with his sword, the Murapasha cables. With the sound of his conch shell, Lord Gadadhar then shattered the magic seals of the fortress, along with the hearts of its brave defenders, and with his heavy club, he demolished the surrounding earthen ramparts. The five-headed demon Mura, who slept at the bottom of the city's moat, awoke and rose up out of the water when he heard the vibration of Lord Krishna's Panchajanya conch shell, a sound as terrifying as the thunder at the end of the cosmic age. Shining with the blinding, terrible effulgence of the sun's fire at the end of a millennium, Mura seemed to be swallowing up the three worlds with his five mouths. He lifted up his trident and fell upon Garuda, the son of Taksha, like an attacking snake. Mura whirled his trident and then hurled it fiercely at Garuda, roaring from all five mouths. The sound filled the earth and sky, all directions and the limits of outer space, until it reverberated against the very shell of the universe. Then, with two arrows, Lord Hari struck the trident flying toward Garuda and broke it into three pieces. Next, the Lord hit Mura's faces with several arrows, and the demon angrily hurled his club at the Lord. As Mura's club sped toward him on the battlefield, Lord Krishna intercepted it with his own and broke it into thousands of pieces. Mura then raised his arms high and rushed at the unconquerable Lord, who easily sliced off his heads with his disc weapon. Lifeless, Mura's decapitated body fell into the water like a mountain whose peak has been severed by the power of Lord Indra's thunderbolt. The demon's seven sons, enraged by their father's death, prepared to retaliate. Ordered by Balmasura, Mura's seven sons, Tamra, Antariksha, Shravana, Vibhavasu, Vasu, Nibasvan, and Aruna, followed their general Pita onto the battlefield bearing their weapons. These fierce warriors furiously attacked invincible Lord Krishna with arrows, swords, clubs, spears, lances, and tridents. But the Supreme Lord, with unfailing prowess, cut this mountain of weapons into tiny pieces with his arrows. The Lord severed the heads, thighs, arms, legs, and armor of these opponents led by Pita, and sent them all to the abode of Yamaraj. Narakasura, the son of the earth, could not contain his fury when he saw the fate of his military leaders. Thus he went out of the citadel with elephants born from the milk ocean, who were exuding mudra from their foreheads out of excitement. Lord Krishna and his wife, mounted upon Garuda, looked like a cloud with lightning sitting above the sun. Seeing the Lord, Bhoma released his Shatagni weapon at him, whereupon all of Bhoma's soldiers simultaneously attacked with their weapons. At that moment, Lord Krishna shot his sharp arrows at Bhomasura's army. These arrows, displaying variegated feathers, soon reduced that army to a mass of bodies with severed arms, thighs, and necks. The Lord similarly killed the opposing horses and elephants. Lord Hari then struck down all the missiles and weapons the enemy soldiers threw at him, destroying each and every one with three sharp arrows. Meanwhile, Garuda, as he carried the Lord, struck the enemy's elephants with his wings. Beaten by Garuda's wings, beak, and talons, the elephants fled back into the city, leaving Narakasura alone on the battlefield to oppose Krishna. Seeing his army driven back and tormented by Garuda, Bhoma attacked him with his spear, which had once defeated Lord Indra's thunderbolt. But though struck by that mighty weapon, Garuda was not shaken. Indeed, he was like an elephant hit with a flower garland. Bhoma, frustrated in all his attempts, took up his trident to kill Lord Krishna. But even before he could release it, the Lord cut off his head with his razor-sharp chakra as the demon sat atop his elephant. Fallen on the ground, Bhomasura's head shone brilliantly, decorated as it was with earrings and an attractive helmet. As cries of "Alas! Alas!" and "Well done!" arose, the sages and principal demigods worshipped Lord Mukunda by showering him with flower garlands. The goddess of the earth then approached Lord Krishna and presented him with Aditi's earrings, which were made of glowing gold inlaid with shining jewels. She also gave him a Vaijayanti flower garland, Varuna's umbrella, and the peak of Mandara Mountain. After bowing down to him and then standing with joined palms, the goddess, her mind filled with devotion, began to praise the Lord of the universe, whom the best of demigods worship. Guru Vacha Namaste Deva Devesha Shankh Chakra Gadadhara Bhakti Chopata Rupaya Dhanamatman Namostute Namatanga Janadhaya Namatanga Janalini Namatanga Janetraya Namaste Tanga Jangraye Namo Bhagavate Tubhyam Vasudevaya Vishnave Purushaya Adibijaya Purnabodhaya Te Namaha Ajaya Janamitresya Brahmane Vinda Shaktihi Paravaratman Bhutatman Pavanatman Namostute. goddess Bhumi said, "Obeisances unto you, O lord of the chief demigods, O holder of the conch shell, disc, and club. O supreme soul within the heart, you assume your various forms to fulfill your devotees' desires. Obeisances unto you. My respectful obeisances are unto you, O lord, whose abdomen is marked with a depression like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus, and whose feet are engraved with lotuses. Obeisances unto you, the supreme lord Vasudev, Vishnu, the primeval person, the original seed. Obeisances unto you, the omniscient one. Obeisances unto you of unlimited energies, the unborn progenitor of this universe, the absolute. O soul of the high and the low, O soul of the created elements, O all-pervading supreme soul, obeisances unto you. Desiring to create, O unborn master, you increase and then assume the mode of passion. You do likewise with the mode of ignorance when you wish to annihilate the universe, and with goodness when you wish to maintain it. Nonetheless, you remain uncovered by these modes. You are time, the pradhan, and the purusha, O lord of the universe, yet still you are separate and distinct. This is illusion. That earth, water, fire, air, ether, sense objects, demigods, mind, the senses, false ego, and the total material energy exist independent of you. In fact, they are all within you, my lord, who are one without a second. Here is the son of Bhomasara. Frightened, he is approaching your lotus feet, since you remove the distress of all who seek refuge in you. Please protect him. Place your lotus hand, which dispels all sins, upon his head. Shukadev Goswami said, thus entreated by Goddess Bhumi in words of humble devotion, the Supreme Lord bestowed fearlessness upon her grandson, and then entered Bhomasara's palace, which was filled with all manner of riches. There Lord Krishna saw 16,000 royal maidens, whom Bhoma had taken by force from various kings. The women became enchanted when they saw that most excellent of males enter. In their minds they accepted him, who had been brought there by destiny, as their chosen husband. With the thought, "May Providence grant that this man become my husband," each and every princess absorbed her heart in contemplation of Krishna. The Lord had the princesses arrayed in clean, spotless garments, and then sent them in palanquins to Dwaraka, together with great treasures of chariots, horses, and other valuables. Lord Krishna also dispatched 64 swift white elephants, descendants of Airavata, who each sported 4 tusks. The Lord then went to the abode of Indra, the demigod's king, and gave Mother Aditi her earrings. There Indra and his wife worshipped Krishna and his beloved consort Satyabhama. Then, at Satyabhama's behest, the Lord uprooted the heavenly Parijata tree and put it on the back of Garuda. After defeating Indra and all the other demigods, Krishna brought the Parijata to his capital. Once planted, the Parijata tree beautified the garden of Queen Satyabhama's palace. Bees followed the tree all the way from heaven, greedy for its fragrance and sweet sap. Even after Indra had bowed down to Lord Achyuta, touched his feet with the tips of his crown, and begged the Lord to fulfill his desire, that exalted demigod, having achieved his purpose, chose to fight with the Supreme Lord. What ignorance there is among the gods! To hell with their opulence! Then the imperishable Supreme Personality, assuming a separate form for each bride, duly married all the princesses simultaneously, each in her own palace. The Lord, performer of the inconceivable, constantly remained in each of his queen's palaces, which were unequaled and unexcelled by any other residence. There, although fully satisfied within himself, he enjoyed with his pleasing wives, and, like an ordinary husband, he carried out his household duties. Thus those women obtained as their husband the husband of the goddess of fortune, although even great demigods like Brahma do not know how to approach him. With ever-increasing pleasure, they experienced loving attraction for him, exchanged smiling glances with him, and reciprocated with him in ever-fresh intimacy, replete with joking and feminine shyness. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, they chose to personally serve the Lord by approaching him humbly, offering him a seat, worshipping him with excellent paraphernalia, bathing and massaging his feet, giving him pan to chew, fanning him, anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, adorning him with flower garlands, dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him, and presenting him with various gifts. Chapter 60. Krishna teases Rukmini. Sri Badarayani said, once, in the company of her maidservants, Queen Rukmini was personally serving her husband, the spiritual master of the universe, by fanning him as he relaxed on her bed. The unborn personality of Godhead, the supreme controller, who creates, maintains, and then devours this universe simply as his play, took birth among the Yadus to preserve his own laws. Queen Rukmini's quarters were extremely beautiful, boasting a canopy hung with brilliant strings of pearls, as well as effulgent jewels serving as lamps. Garlands of jasmine and other flowers hung here and there, attracting swarms of humming bees, and the spotless rays of the moon shone through the holes of the lattice windows. As a guru incense drifted out of the window holes, the breeze wafting the scent of the Parijata grove carried the mood of a garden into the room. There the queen served her husband, the supreme lord of all the worlds, as he reclined upon an opulent pillow on her bed, which was as soft and white as the foam of milk. From her maidservant's hand, Goddess Rukmini took a yak hair fan with a jeweled handle, and then she began to worship her master by fanning him. Her hand adorned with rings, bangles, and the chamara fan, Queen Rukmini looked resplendent standing near Lord Krishna. Her jeweled ankle bells tinkled, and her necklace glittered, reddened by the kumkum from her breasts, which were covered by the end of her sari. On her hips, she wore a priceless belt. As he contemplated her, the goddess of fortune herself, who desires only him, Lord Krishna smiled. The Lord assumes various forms to enact his pastimes, and he was pleased that the form the goddess of fortune had assumed was just suitable for her to serve as his consort. Her charming face was adorned with curling hair, earrings, a locket on her neck, and the nectar of her bright, happy smile. The Lord then spoke to her as follows. My dear princess, you were sought after by many kings as powerful as the rulers of planets. They were all abundantly endowed with political influence, wealth, beauty, generosity, and physical strength. Since your brother and father offered you to them, why did you reject the king of Chedi and all those other suitors who stood before you maddened by Cupid? Why, instead, did you choose us, who are not at all your equal? Terrified of these kings, O lovely proud one, we took shelter in the ocean. We have become enemies of powerful men, and we practically abandoned our royal throne. O fine proud lady, women are usually destined to suffer when they stay with men whose behavior is uncertain and who pursue a path not approved by society. We have no material possessions, and we are dear to those who similarly have nothing. Therefore, O slender one, the wealthy hardly ever worship me. Marriage and friendship are proper between two people who are equal in terms of their wealth, birth, influence, physical appearance, and capacity for a good progeny, but never between a superior and an inferior. O Vaidarbhi, not being far-sighted, you didn't realize this, and therefore you chose us as your husband, even though we have no good qualities and are glorified only by deluded beggars. Now you should definitely accept a more suitable husband, a first-class man of the royal order who can help you achieve everything you want, both in this life and the next. Kings like Shishupal, Shalva, Jarasandha, and Dantavakra all hate me, O beautiful flag one, and so does your elder brother Rukmini. It was to dispel the arrogance of these kings that I carried you away, my good woman, for they were blinded by the intoxication of power. My purpose was to curb the strength of the wicked. We care nothing for wives, children, and wealth. Always satisfied within ourselves, we do not work for body and home, but like a light, we merely witness. Shukadev Goswami said, Rukmini had thought herself especially beloved by the Lord, because he never left her company. By saying these things to her, he vanquished her pride, and then he stopped speaking. Goddess Rukmini had never before heard such unpleasantries from her beloved, the Lord of Universal Rulers, and she became frightened. A tremor arose in her heart, and in terrible anxiety, she began to cry. With her tender foot, effulgent with the reddish glow of her nails, she scratched the ground, and tears darkened by her eye makeup sprinkled her crimson reddened breasts. There she stood, face downward, her voice choked up by extreme sorrow. Lipmany's mind was overwhelmed with unhappiness, fear, and grief. Her bangle slipped from her hand, and her fan fell to the ground. In her bewilderment, she suddenly fainted, her hair scattering all about as her body fell to the ground like a plantain tree blown over by the wind. Seeing that his beloved was so bound to him in love that she could not understand the full meaning of his teasing, merciful Lord Krishna felt compassion for her. The Lord quickly got down from the bed. Manifesting four arms, he picked her up, gathered her hair, and caressed her face with his lotus hand. Wiping her tear-filled eyes and her breasts, which were stained by tears of grief, the Supreme Lord, the goal of his devotees, embraced his chaste wife, who desired nothing but him, O King. Expert in the art of pacification, Sri Krishna tenderly consoled pitiable Rukmini, whose mind was bewildered by his clever joking, and who did not deserve to suffer so. The Supreme Lord said, O Vaidarbhi, do not be displeased with me. I know that you are fully devoted to me. I only spoke in jest, dear lady, because I wanted to hear what you would say. I also wanted to see your face with lips trembling in loving anger, the reddish corners of your eyes throwing sidelong glances, and the line of your beautiful eyebrows knit in a frown. The greatest pleasure worldly householders can enjoy at home is to spend time joking with their beloved wives, my dear timid and temperamental one. Shukadev Goswami said, O King, Queen Vaidarbhi was fully pacified by the Supreme Personality of Godhead and understood that his words had been spoken in jest. Thus she gave up her fear that her beloved would reject her. Smiling bashfully as she cast charming, affectionate glances upon the face of the Lord, the best of males, Rukmini spoke the following, O descendant of Bharat. Shri Rukmini Vacha Nande Vameta Radavinda Valochanaha Yadvain Havan Bhagavato Sadrishi Vibhuna Kvase Mahinya Virito Bhagavan Stradisha Kvahanguna Prakitiragya Guhita Pada Satyam Vayadi Bhagune Vihurukkamanta Shete Samindra Ubalam Bhamanatva Atma Nityam kar indriya ganai kata vinva hastam Tvat seva karna tapadam vidutam tamonham Vat vara padma makadam nidusham muninam Vat asputam nipashibinam duvibhavyam Yasma valaukikam vehitam ishwarasya Bhumansa vehitam tohim ye bhavantam Sri Rukmini said, Actually, what you have said is true, O Lotus-Eyed One. I am indeed unsuitable for the Almighty Personality of Godhead. What comparison is there between that Supreme Lord, who is master of the three primal deities and who delights in his own glory, and myself, a woman of mundane qualities whose feet are grasped by fools? Yes, my Lord Urukram, you lay down within the ocean as if afraid of the material modes, and thus in pure consciousness you appear within the heart as the Supersoul. You are always battling against the foolish material senses, and indeed even your servants reject the privilege of royal dominion, which leads to the blindness of ignorance. Your movements, inscrutable even for sages who relish the honey of your lotus feet, are certainly incomprehensible for human beings who behave like animals. And just as your activities are transcendental, O all-powerful Lord, so too are those of your followers. You possess nothing because there is nothing beyond you. Even the great enjoyers of tribute, Brahma and other demigods, pay tribute to you. Those who are blinded by their wealth and absorbed in gratifying their senses do not recognize you in the form of death. But to the gods, the enjoyers of tribute, you are the most dear as they are to you. You are the embodiment of all human goals, and are yourself the final aim of life. Desiring to attain you, O all-powerful Lord, intelligent persons abandon everything else. It is they who are worthy of your association, not men and women absorbed in the pleasure and grief resulting from their mutual lust. Knowing that great sages who have renounced the sannyasi's danda proclaim your glories, that you are the supreme soul of all the worlds, and that you are so gracious that you give away even your own self, I chose you as my husband, rejecting Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the rulers of heaven, whose aspirations are all frustrated by the force of time, which is born from your eyebrows. What interest, then, could I have in any other suitors? My lord, as a lion drives away lesser animals to claim his proper tribute, you drove away the assembled kings with the resounding twang of your shanga bow, and then claimed me, your fair share. Thus it is sheer foolishness, my dear Gadagaja, for you to say you took shelter in the ocean out of fear of those kings. Wanting your association, the best of kings, Anga, Vainya, Jayanta, Nahusha, Gaya, and others, abandoned their absolute sovereignty and entered the forest to seek you out. How could those kings suffer frustration in this world, O lotus-eyed one? The aroma of your lotus feet, which is glorified by great saints, awards people liberation and is the abode of Goddess Lakshmi. What woman would take shelter of any other man after savoring that aroma? Since you are the abode of transcendental qualities, what mortal woman with the insight to distinguish her own true interest would disregard that fragrance and depend instead on someone who is always subject to terrible fear? Because you are suitable for me, I have chosen you, the master and supreme soul of all the worlds, who fulfill our desires in this life and the next. May your feet, which give freedom from illusion by approaching their worshipper, give shelter to me, who have been wandering from one material situation to another. O infallible Krishna, let each of the kings you named become the husband of a woman whose ears have never heard your glories, which are sung in the assemblies of Shiva and Brahma. After all, in the households of such women, these kings live like asses, oxen, dogs, cats, and slaves. A woman who fails to relish the fragrance of the honey of your lotus feet becomes totally befooled, and thus she accepts as her husband or lover a living corpse covered with skin, whiskers, nails, head hair, and body hair, and filled with flesh, bones, blood, parasites, feces, mucus, bile, and air. O lotus-eyed one, though you are satisfied within yourself and thus rarely turn your attention toward me, please bless me with steady love for your feet. It is when you assume a predominance of passion in order to manifest the universe that you glance upon me, showing me what is indeed your greatest mercy. Actually, I don't consider your words false, Madhusudan. Quite often an unmarried girl is attracted to a man, as in the case of Amba. The mind of a promiscuous woman always hankers for new lovers, even if she is married. An intelligent man should not keep such an unchaste wife, for if he does, he will lose his good fortune both in this life and the next. The Supreme Lord said, O saintly lady, O princess, we deceived you only because we wanted to hear you speak like this. Indeed, everything you said in reply to my words is most certainly true. Whatever benedictions you hope for in order to become free of material desires are ever yours, O fair and noble lady, for you are my unalloyed devotee. O sinless one, I have now seen firsthand the pure love and chaste attachments you have for your husband. Even though shaken by my words, your mind could not be pulled away from me. Although I have the power to award spiritual liberation, lusty persons worship me with penance and vows in order to get my blessings for their mundane family life. Such persons are bewildered by my illusory energy. O supreme reservoir of love, unfortunate are they who, even after obtaining me, the lord of both liberation and material riches, hanker only for material treasures. These worldly gains can be found even in hell. Since such persons are obsessed with sense gratification, hell is a fitting place for them. Fortunately, O mistress of the house, you have always rendered me faithful devotional service, which liberates one from material existence. This service is very difficult for the envious to perform, especially for a woman whose intentions are wicked, who lives only to gratify her bodily demands, and who indulges in duplicity. In all my palaces, I can find no other wife as loving as you, O most respectful one. When you were to be married, You disregarded all the kings who had assembled to seek your hand, and simply because you had heard authentic accounts concerning me, you sent a Brahmin to me with your confidential message. When your brother, who had been defeated in battle and then disfigured, was later killed during a gambling match on Aniruddha's wedding day, you felt unbearable grief. Yet out of fear of losing me, you spoke not a word. By this silence, you have conquered me. When you sent the messenger with your most confidential plan, and yet I delayed going to you, you began to see the whole world as void and wanted to quit your body, which could never have been given to anyone but me. May this greatness of yours remain with you always. I can do nothing to reciprocate except joyfully thank you for your devotion. Shukadeva Goswami said, and so the self-satisfied Supreme Lord of the universe, enjoyed with the Goddess of Fortune, engaging her in lovers' talks and thus imitating the ways of human society. The Almighty Lord Hari, preceptor of all the worlds, similarly behaved like a conventional householder in the palaces of his other queens, performing the religious duties of a family man. Chapter 61. Lord Balaram Slays Rukmi. Shukadeva Goswami said, each of Lord Krishna's wives gave birth to 10 sons, who were not less than their father, having all his personal opulence. Because each of these princesses saw that Lord Achyuta never left her palace, each thought herself the Lord's favorite. These women did not understand the full truth about him. The Supreme Lord's wives were fully enchanted by his lovely lotus-like face, his long arms and large eyes, his loving glances imbued with laughter, and his charming talks with them. But with all their charms, these ladies could not conquer the mind of the all-powerful Lord. The arched eyebrows of these 16,000 queens enchantingly expressed those ladies' secret intentions through coyly smiling sidelong glances. Thus their eyebrows boldly sent forth conjugal messages. Yet even with these arrows of Cupid, and with other means as well, they could not agitate Lord Krishna's senses. Thus these women obtained as their husband the master of the Goddess of Fortune, although even great demigods like Brahma do not know how to approach him. With ever-increasing pleasure, they felt loving attraction for him, exchanged smiling glances with him, eagerly anticipated associating with him in ever-fresh intimacy, and enjoyed in many other ways. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, they chose to personally serve the Lord by approaching him humbly, offering him a seat, worshipping him with excellent paraphernalia, bathing and massaging his feet, giving him pan to chew, fanning him, anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, adorning him with flower garlands, dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him, and presenting him with various gifts. Among Lord Krishna's wives, each of whom had 10 sons, I previously mentioned 8 principal queens. I shall now recite for you the names of those 8 queen sons, headed by Pradyumna. The first son of Queen Rukmini was Pradyumna, and also born of her were Charudeshna, Sudeshna, and the powerful Charudeha, along with Sucharu, Charugupta, Bhadracharu, Charuchandra, Vicharu, and Charu the 10th. None of these sons of Lord Hari was less than his father. The 10 sons of Satyabhama were Bhanu, Subhanu, Swabhanu, Prabhanu, Bhanuman, Chandrabhanu, Brihadbhanu, Atibhanu, the 8th, Shubhanu, and Patibhanu. Sanda, Sumitra, Purujit, Shatajit, Sahasrajit, Vijay, Chitraketu, Vasunam, Dravida, and Kratu were the sons of Jambavati. These 10, headed by Sanda, were their father's favorites. The sons of Nagmajiti were Vira, Chandra, Ashwasen, Chitragu, Vegavan, Visha, Ama, Shankhu, Vasu, and the opulent Kunti. Shruta, Kavi, Grisha, Vira, Subahu, Bhadra, Shanti, Darsha, and Purnamasa were sons of Kalindi. Her youngest son was Somaka. Madra's sons were Pagosh, Gatravan, Sinha, Bala, Tabala, Udhara, Mahashakti, Saha, Oja, and Aparajita. Mitravinda's sons were Vrika, Harsha, Anila, Gudra, Vardhana, Unnada, Mahansa, Bhavana, Vanni, and Shuddhi. saying Ramajit, we have seen Shura, Pahavana, Arajit, Jai, and Subhadra were the sons of Bhadra, together with Vama, Ayur, and Satyaka. Deeptiman, Tamratapta, and others were the sons of Lord Krishna and Rohini. Lord Krishna's son Pradyumna fathered the greatly powerful Aniruddha in the womb of Rukmavati, the daughter of Rukmi. O King, this took place while they were living in the city of Bhojakata. My dear King, the sons and grandsons of Lord Krishna's children numbered in the tens of millions. 16,000 mothers gave rise to this dynasty. King Parikshit said, how could Rukmi give his daughter to his enemy's son? After all, Rukmi had been defeated by Lord Krishna in battle and was waiting for an opportunity to kill him. Please explain this to me, O Learned One, how these two inimical parties became united through marriage. Mystic yogis can perfectly see that which has not yet happened, as well as things in the past or present, beyond the senses, remote or blocked by physical obstacles. Sri Shukadev Goswami said, at her Swayamvara ceremony, Rukmavati herself chose Pradyumna, who was the re-embodiment of Cupid. Then, although he fought alone on a single chariot, Pradyumna defeated the assembled kings in battle and took her away. Though Rukmi always remembered his enmity toward Lord Krishna, who had insulted him, in order to please his sister, he sanctioned his daughter's marriage to his nephew. Bali, the son of Kritavarma, married Rukmini's young daughter, large-eyed Charumati. Rukmi gave his granddaughter, Rochana, to his daughter's son, Aniruddha, despite Rukmi's relentless feud with Lord Hari. Although Rukmi considered this marriage irreligious, he wanted to please his sister, bound as he was by the ropes of affection. On the joyous occasion of that marriage, O King, Queen Rukmini, Lord Balaram, Lord Krishna, and several of the Lord's sons, headed by Samba and Pradyumna, went to the city of Bhojakata. After the wedding, a group of arrogant kings headed by the king of Kalinga told Rukmi, you should defeat Balaram at dice. He's not expert at dice, O King, but still he's quite addicted to it. Thus advised, Rukmi challenged Balaram and began a gambling match with him. In that match, Lord Balaram first accepted a wager of 100 coins, then 1,000, then 10,000. Rukmi won this first round, and the king of Kalinga laughed loudly at Lord Balaram, showing all his teeth. Lord Balaram could not tolerate this. Next, Rukmi accepted a bet of 100,000 coins, which Lord Balaram won. But Rukmi tried to cheat, declaring, I'm the winner! Shaking with anger like the ocean on the full moon day, handsome Lord Balaram, his naturally reddish eyes even redder in his fury, accepted a wager of 100 million gold coins. Lord Balaram fairly won this wager also, but Rukmi again resorted to cheating and declared, I have won! Let these witnesses here say what they saw! Just then a voice from the sky declared, Balaram has fairly won this wager. Rukmi is surely lying. Urged on by the wicked kings, Rukmi ignored the divine voice. In fact, destiny itself was urging Rukmi on, and thus he ridiculed Lord Balaram as follows. You cowherds who wander about the forest know nothing about dice. Playing with dice and sporting with arrows are only for kings, not for the likes of you. Thus insulted by Rukmi and ridiculed by the kings, Lord Balaram was provoked to anger. In the midst of the auspicious wedding assembly, he raised his club and struck Rukmi dead. The king of Kalinga, who had laughed at Lord Balaram and shown his teeth, tried to run away, but the furious lord quickly seized him on his tenth step and knocked out all his teeth. Tormented by Lord Balaram's club, the other kings fled in fear, their arms, thighs, and heads broken, and their bodies drenched in blood. When his brother-in-law Rukmi was slain, Lord Krishna neither applauded nor protested, O King, for he feared jeopardizing his affectionate ties with either Rukmini or Balaram. Then the descendants of Bishaha, headed by Lord Balaram, seated Aniruddha and his bride on a fine chariot and set off from Bhojakata for Dwaraka. Having taken shelter of Lord Madhusudan, they had fulfilled all their purposes. Chapter 62, The Meeting of Usha and Aniruddha. King Parikshit said, "The best of the Yadus married Banasura's daughter, Usha, and as a result a great fearsome battle occurred between Lord Hari and Lord Shankara. Please explain everything about this incident, O most powerful of mystics." Shukadev Goswami said, "Bana was the oldest of the 100 sons fathered by the great saint Bali Maharaj, who gave the whole earth in charity to Lord Hari when he appeared as Vamanadev. Banasura, born from Bali's semen, became a great devotee of Lord Shiva. His behavior was always respectable, and he was generous, intelligent, truthful, and firm in his vows. The beautiful city of Shonitapur was under his dominion. Because Lord Shiva had favored him, the demigods waited on Banasura like menial servants. Once, when Shiva was dancing his Tandava Nritya, Bana especially satisfied the Lord by playing a musical accompaniment with his 1,000 arms. The Lord and Master of all created beings, the compassionate refuge of his devotees, gladdened Banasura by offering him the benediction of his choice. Bana chose to have him, Lord Shiva, as the guardian of his city. Banasura was intoxicated with his strength. One day, when Lord Shiva was standing beside him, Banasura touched the Lord's lotus feet with his helmet, which shone like the sun, and spoke to him as follows.